From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer and scientist Carl Safina says, here's the thing that makes it difficult for us to imagine animals as feeling complicated emotions like love or grief. It's that we humans have a difficult time not comparing animals to ourselves. But what if we didn't? What if being human wasn't the measure of all things? This was a realization Safina came to while writing his latest book. It's a book where he tracks down the scientific evidence for what's going on inside another animal's mind, what they're thinking and feeling. Does an animal have a notion of beauty, for example, or empathy? Does it understand the concept of death? Is it conscious? Safina is joining us today to make his case. His book is called Beyond Words. Join us after the news.
KUER's volunteers give their time year-round to lend a helping hand. Our volunteers staff booths at special events, help with paperwork in our membership department, and assist the News and Radio West teams with behind-the-scenes details. Maybe you're a photographer or a graphic designer and you'd like to volunteer your skills. Or you have some spare time that you'd like to donate. We're always grateful for a little extra help from our friends. Find out more about volunteer opportunities at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Carl Safina thought it was a great question, really the big question. He was in Kenya interviewing a researcher who had devoted decades to observing elephants. Here's the question. What has a lifetime of watching these creatures taught you about humanity? And it's a good question, right? But the researcher, a terrific lady whom we'll talk about later on the program, pushed back. She wasn't interested in elephants from a human perspective. I'm interested in them as elephants, she said. In his new book, Safina describes that response as a kind of course correction. He had gone into the project wanting to let animals show how much they are like us, but now he thinks about it differently. His book is his attempt to see, as he puts it, who animals simply are, whether they're like us or not. Safina is examining the scientific evidence to tell us what's going on inside another animal's mind, what they're thinking, what they're feeling. The book is called Beyond Words. Carl Safina is joining us today to talk about it. He's the founding president of the Safina Center at Stony Brook University on Long Island, where he also co-chairs the university's Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Carl Safina, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for inviting me on.
There's a question that you break down right up front in the book, and I wanted to ask you of, here's the question, who are you? Because it's a question that kind of makes perfect sense, obviously, if you're a human, but you say science is uncomfortable with the question if you're asking it about an animal, and I wanted to know why you think that is. Why does science seem to steer away sometimes from the inner lives of animals?
Yeah, I think the key word in that last question you just asked me is sometimes, because, you know, science is an endeavor by human beings, and like everything about human beings, there's a huge range of how it's approached. But yes, in general, there's been, in the study of behavior, there's been a tremendous unease about going there, going into the minds of animals. It follows a little bit of a general cultural thing that we've had for centuries in the West, especially, where, you know, we've decided that we are the master race. We're the only ones who can think, and these other creatures simply have no thoughts or anything going on in their mind, as was said for centuries. And then when people tried to create a science of animal behavior, they basically said, we just don't know what's going on in their heads, so we can... Our science will be to describe what we see them doing because we can see them doing it.
Yeah.
And that makes sense, you know, and you shouldn't assume anything. You shouldn't assume that they are thinking or feeling anything. And that's good. But to then insist that they don't think or feel anything is not scientific because you close a gigantic question.
Yeah.
Just saying, you know, we will not address that question. That's not scientific. But that's where the behavioral sciences went. And to a large extent, they're still there. there's a new journal out called Animal Sentience, and it's sort of created on an argument format where someone poses a statement and then other people can respond to it. And in this first issue, there's the question of, do fish feel pain? Mm-hmm. And someone argues on the basis of fish brains that fish can't feel anything. And then a lot of people, about 20 people, respond, and about 17 of those responses are, oh, yes, they can. And the debate rages on.
So you get a sense that that it might be changing in some way. The more we observe and understand about animals, the like good scientists, we're changing our minds, or our ideas about the way the inner lives of animals are evolving in good ways, I suppose.
I think there is an opening
yeah.
to the question anyway, which is completely appropriate. I mean, scientists should always be open to every question. Yeah.
You tell this story in the book about watching this pod of dolphins splashing around and playing in the water. And you say that you started to feel unsatisfied, is how you put it, that you wanted more intimacy. Would you tell me a little bit more about that story? What was it that you were thinking, and how were you thinking about that?
Yeah, I was on a boat in the Gulf of California in Baja, Mexico, and I actually happened to be reading a book about elephants, a book by Gay Bradshaw about elephants and psychological traumas that elephants can suffer. She was talking about it from a—I mean, I always assume that animals can have psychological traumas. You can easily see that with dogs that have been abused. But her thesis was articulated in a way I hadn't quite considered before, which was basically their brains are the same as ours, and therefore when we see trauma in an elephant, it's not an analogy. It's exactly the same thing. I hadn't quite thought of it that way before, and I thought that was certainly interesting. And while I was ruminating about elephants and wondering if this is true or the right way to approach it, we were seeing many, many dolphins. And usually you see wild animals and you just name them. You say, oh, look, dolphins.
Right.
They're a group. They're jumping through the water. It's beautiful, but it's like scenery. And I just started to, you know, I wanted to look deeper. And I realized that, of course, they are mammals. You see them with their babies. The mm-hmm. babies are with their mothers. Clearly, you see that as a relationship that is there. And then I wondered, you know, what are all of their relationships? We know they have big brains. We know they're very vocal. What are they doing and saying? And instead of this thing of what are they are dolphins, I needed a different question. And the different question was, who are you?
Yeah. It seems like this idea of individuality, it's a kind of a big theme in the book. Cynthia Moss, she's the we'll get to her a little bit more in the program. Mm-hmm. She's the woman that you asked that question of, the elephant
research.
Yeah, amazing. And she told you that if you look at a group of animals, you're just seeing these two flat dimensions. But when you mm-hmm. look at one animal, then you're seeing something. You're seeing something else, and this seemed like kind of an important theme in there—the idea of personality and individuality.
Yes, and ironically, the more social the animal lives, the more individual each one is, and
yeah.
the more each one has a personality that plays out in the trajectory of their lifetimes over what is essentially the arc of their career. But it takes a long time to see that, and you need to know individuals and watch them for decades, really, or at least quite a few years.
Yeah. Well, but Cynthia Moss told you it took her 20 years to get to that realization.
20 years yeah. for her living there.
Yeah, exactly.
To get to that realization, yes, exactly, right. I mean, that's – first of all, it's a humbling thought. But that kind of humbling is very expansive because a door opens with a realization like that, that you can't just get it by glancing. Mm-hmm. And there are layers and layers and layers that can reveal, but you need to invest. And I mean, to me, that's thrilling, that idea of that there's so much there, that we sit on the surface of something so incredibly rich, this mother load of lifetimes and mental experiences, in addition to, you know, the dramas and the great beauties and all of that kind of stuff. I think that's just absolutely thrilling. It makes it seem like we're suddenly on a new planet.
There's a native Maasai woman that you met in Kenya, works with Cynthia Moss.
Yes, Katito.
Katito. You need to tell a little bit about her, because she says she knows, and I think that's a crucial word, she knows more than 900 elephants.
On sight.
On sight.
She knows them on sight. She glances at them, and there are certain ways you can sort of break it down, because the elephants live in a group with basically with their mothers. And the oldest female leads the group. She's often called the matriarch. She lives with all of her adult daughters and all of their children, except that when the males get to be adolescents, they leave and they form loose male groups, whereas the females form very tight family groups. So sometimes she glances and she just knows what family it is. And then if she looks a little more closely, she knows who everybody is. But there are others. She just looks at them and she knows them the way that you would know your friend. You know, you don't piece out who your friend is when they walk in the room. You just glance and you know. And she can do that with all these elephants. The funniest thing was she said to me something about this one family, and she said, they're sort of round looking and they have big ears. And I said, they're elephants. They're all round looking and they have big ears. But to her, it was, you know, a major attribute of this particular family. They were a little rounder and their ears were a little bigger.
How did you choose the you write about a lot of animal groups, but particularly three, the elephants, the wolves in Yellowstone, and also killer whales. How did you pick those three? I mean, did you want to just sort of distill it down to particular groups? Or, I mean, how did you go about thinking about that?
Yeah, you know, I just want to add to the last comment that the elephants know each other that way as well. It's not just people know, you know, an expert knows 900 and the elephants have no idea who's who. They know hundreds of individuals themselves. They know individual families. They know them by their call, by their looks. They're more or less friendly with different families. Sometimes one family will hear another one and they'll just say, those are our friends over there. Let's go visit them. Mm. And those will be two families that often do that. To get to the question you just asked me, why these particular three, I thought that it's easy for humans, easier for humans, to start to consider the lives of other animals by starting with some other animals whose lives are a little bit more like us. In other words, they're very social. We are very social. Mm-hmm. And I want to, I just want to look at who are the most social among other animals. And I came up with a short list, and I needed to pick three because I just think describe the universe and give three examples is sort of like a good little cheat sheet for approaching a story. Four or five examples gets to be too much. So there are a few others. There's parrots and ravens and lions, hyenas, many of the other kinds of whales and things like that. There's a number of others. I couldn't focus on all of those, although all of those are mentioned in the book. But I decided to focus on three extremely social animals. And I picked three that were, they were sort of different from one another despite these social similarities. There were also several that had a long history of a couple of people getting to know them extremely well. Mm. And that was going to be really crucial. Because as the book began to develop a little bit, I realized that I wanted to focus on free-living animals for whom individuals were known well over a long time, and that really became what the book was oriented toward. Yeah,
I guess there must be a big difference in perception between a scientist who observes an animal in a laboratory environment and one who observes animals in their natural environment. I guess that seems super obvious, but have you found?
Well, first of all, it's not obvious. Really. And secondly, it has an obvious answer, but it also has a big nuanced middle. The obvious answer is that when an animal is in captivity or in an apparatus where it's running a maze or figuring out a puzzle, that's not who the animal is.
Yeah.
When an animal is living a free living life in its natural habitat, it doesn't quite show you necessarily, but it does all the things that it does and everything that it is physically and mentally geared to do. So that's how you could get to know the animal. Now the squishy middle ground is that insightful experimenters can design interesting apparati or apparatuses that really can tease out some very interesting things about certain animals. And you can learn some great stuff in laboratories and with experiments, but you can also have incredibly dopey experimental setups that teach you essentially nothing and miss almost everything that creature is capable of doing and normally does for itself in its appropriate context.
Carl Safina is with us. His book is Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. He's a conservationist, a writer, a university professor. And we'll take a quick break and be back and talk more about these animals in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what animals think and feel. Do they experience joy, for example, or grief, or love, or jealousy? Carl Safina says, of course they do, and he's written a book that makes the case that animals have refined personalities, a sense of consciousness. His book is called Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel, and he's joining us today from a studio in New York City. There's the story you tell in the book. You're watching elephants with this scientist, and this person says to you this. He says, I have no way of knowing whether that elephant that you were watching at the particular moment is any more conscious than this bush. The idea of consciousness is you really dig into here. What was he getting? He was trying to be objective, you say, but it just seemed kind of absurd on some level. What was he trying to say there?
I think he was trying to say that he had been taught this as a way of looking at the world. It's an absurd statement.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to say we could never know exactly what an elephant is thinking, but to say I have no way of knowing whether an elephant is more conscious than a bush, well, the elephant has eyes and ears. It has an incredibly sensitive nose. It worries about its babies and cares for them. It needs to move around and make decisions about where to go and when to go there. It does appropriate things. It finds shade. I mean, to say there's no way of knowing if it's more conscious than a bush is a way of showing how unconscious he was. It was an absurd thing to say. But it wasn't – although it was shocking, it was also not very surprising that a person trained as a certain kind of scientist – and he was mostly into technology. He was there you know what? I shouldn't say any more.
Okay.
About why he was there, but he wasn't you know trained in behavior, and he wasn't like incredibly empathic about the creatures that we were watching. But he did reflect a view that is remarkably widespread, and that view kind of is: if I'm going to be objective and assume nothing, then I can never conclude anything from the evidence. Now, that is not scientific, because what science is about is we don't assume anything. We look at the evidence and we believe what the evidence shows. That's what science is supposed to do. So there's a lot of weird thinking out there, even among people who are professional scientists. And there's still this, you know, incredible swirling morass of confusion about even how to think about animals. Or what does the definition of these words mean? What you say, oh, is it conscious or not conscious? First, we need to say, what does that word mean in the context of what we're going to talk about?
Right. We're starting an entire series, actually, on this program about consciousness. And you sort of ask that critical question, what does consciousness – how does it, for example, emerge in living creatures?
Right.
How does a brain, as you put it in the book, create a mind? Do you think you have a sense of that? And I mean, to that, I think this is another in that litany of things where we've always thought we only humans have this idea. And all those things are sort of falling by the wayside eventually. But where do animals fit in this idea of consciousness, do you think?
Right. Well, first of all, humans are animals. So we're talking about animals. We can talk about all of us because it applies to all of us. And everything about life exists on a range. It's not us against everything else, although that's how we pose ourselves. But we need a definition, first of all. So I was coming very close to a definition that I actually wound up stumbling upon Christoph Koch's definition. He's a neurologist. And he says, consciousness is the thing that feels like something. If you feel something, you are conscious. Full stop. If you go and get general anesthesia, you are rendered unconscious, which is to say all your sensations are taken away from you temporarily. You're rendered unconscious. Now, most of everything that actually our bodies do is done unconsciously. Our entire digestive system, our entire immune system, all our growth, all our repair when we get an injury or a cut, pregnancy and fetal development. Many, many things about us are run unconsciously. But then on top of that, we have this layer of something that feels like something. And our senses feed into these centers. And we know that consciousness is in the mind. And how do we know that in the brain. Mm-hmm. How do we know that consciousness is in the brain and that the brain creates the mind? Because when the brain is seriously damaged or when parts of the brain are removed, there's no consciousness anymore. That's how we know. So if we look at other brains, we see a few things. One is that we see, as I put it, the logic, the workings of a mind. We see the workings of a mind in the logic of behaviors. Yeah. If it's very hot and sunny out and elephants lead their babies into the shade and then let the babies go to sleep on the ground while they doze, but they continue to stand there touching one another and remaining vigilant, you see the logic of their minds in the behaviors that you're observing. And then from that, you can easily infer that they don't like to be in the bright sun, that they feel too hot in the bright sun, that they seek shade. They know that they can let their babies rest. They know that they can never completely drop their guard. Somebody has to be looking out for danger. They make sense of the world in ways that are very similar to how we make sense of the world. Why would that be? Because they live in the savannas of Africa where we became human. In the same place. I mean, we had the same imperative. Stay alive. Those whoops and howls that you hear, those are dangerous. They're hyenas. The roars are lions. Those are dangerous. There are poisonous snakes. Watch out. It's too hot. Go in the shade. I mean, all of these things, that how we make sense of the world is how they make sense of the world. We live in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
Their brains are structured very, very similar to ours. They have the same chemicals that create mood and motivation in our brains are in those brains. So there's a lot that you can say. You can look at evolution. You can look at the structure of the brain and the nervous system, and you can watch the sensibilities with which they perform behaviors. So that's, in my opinion, that's how you can tell, and that you can learn a lot that way.
Well, you quote Darwin, for example, talking about observing worms. And he said, look, if I look at the worms here, they seem to be adjusting based on conditions. They seem to be learning. And so they deserve, he said, to be called intelligent. And Darwin and others seem to be talking about that the same mechanisms are at play in humans that are at play in worms, in the sense that we evolved these particular mechanisms. Why wouldn't we assume that if we have some sort of consciousness, that we, you know, because we have certain behaviors we evolved, why wouldn't we assume the same thing about emotions and feelings, those sorts of things, right?
Well, yes, right. And, you know, an incredible thing about worms is that we have oxytocin that makes us feel warm and affectionate and sexual and take care of our babies and all of those nice affilial kind of things. And worms have almost exactly the same chemical. And if you mess up that chemical in the worms, they don't seek mates effectively, mm-hmm. and they don't copulate properly. So, I mean, that in itself is very humbling. Although I guess it's not much of a leap to think that there's not a lot of thinking that goes into human sex. But the other thing about Darwin is the most secure man I've ever come across. I mean, he considers every possibility. Nothing threatens him. The idea that that a worm might have a certain level of intelligence is to him an interesting question. It's not a threat. You know, he's not worried that a worm is going to challenge his superiority.
That gets us to a question, one of the great questions you explore in the book, and here it is. Does an elephant nurse her baby because of instinct or because of love? And what I think is so interesting about that question is it kind of gets at the idea of whether nursing is an impulse, just kind of a chemical reaction. You mentioned oxytocin and how that drives bonding, or whether love is instinct. I mean, what did you find out about that? And I guess we can apply that same idea to ourselves, whether or not we're just a collection of these chemical reactions that we interpret as love and bonding and care and all of those things.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Those are just motivations that our body makes for us. Our body and our brain, you know, make us feel love and care.
Yeah.
And that makes us perform behaviors that help us to survive. Now, it doesn't take away from the magnificence of love to understand that love is something that we are compelled and driven to do in certain ways, and that we modify our response based on our conscious ability to consider certain things about it. It overlaps. It's not either or. It's not instinct or love. It's that love is instinctual.
Yeah.
And we feel these motivations, and they let us do things that become truly magnificent.
Let's talk about grief. You say in the book, an elephant's response to death, for example, has been called probably the strangest thing about them. Would you talk about that, that there's this kind of unsettling silence in that reaction?
Elephants do have a very strange and almost unique in a way, unique response to death and dying among themselves. They get very, very, very solemn. First of all, if an elephant is having trouble, it gets help usually. If an elephant collapses, she usually gets lifted to her feet, or somebody tries to raise her up again and steady her. But if she dies, and I say she because these are usually the dynamics that play out in these family groups.
Right.
Then usually there's a vigil. The family doesn't leave for a long time. Then they leave to eat and drink, and then they come back, and they'll come back and do this for a few days at a time. Now, again, we need a definition of grief. Mm-hmm. We need to define all of these things. So Barbara J. King has a wonderful definition that I really like, and it's basically that grief is when you've lost a companion and you alter your behavior around the loss of that companion, that is a show of grief. It's not the way grief feels, but it's how you can tell that there's grief. So the elephants stop foraging the way they would normally forage. They're not going to the places for the duration of time they would normally go. They're hanging out around the dead one. Her friends from other families may come and hang out and come back for a number of days. How does that compare with human behavior? Well, it's very, very similar because usually if we lose someone close to us, we go to awake, and that lasts just a few days. And then we may get on with our lives and pretty much completely heal. We may never completely heal. It's a variable response. And one of the amazing stories is that in Cynthia Moss's camp, usually if they find an elephant skull, they often bring it to the camp because later on they can take a tooth out of it and they can see things about how old the elephant was by the tooth. So there are things you can learn from the skulls. So they have the skulls there, and this family of elephant comes through the camp, and they happen to go more or less directly among the skulls that are there to the skull of one of their family members who had died. The matriarch of this family had died, and they hang around for a while, and then they do a lot of fondling of the bones and the skull. And when they're fondling the skull, they do a lot of feeling of the tusks and the teeth. And when they meet in life, instead of hugging and shaking hands the way that we do, they extend their trunks to each other's faces and often into each other's mouths. So that the teeth and the tusks are how the most recognizable remaining parts of that elephant. And that's what they focus their attention on. Then the family moved away, except for one who lingered a long time, and that was the son of the female whose skull he was standing next to. Was her son.
Wow.
And he stayed the longest. Amazing.
It's amazing. There's another, I have to say, amazing story of this Amazon parrot named Tico, who grieves the death of this elderly woman. It would, in fact, attack the hospice workers in the days before she died. I mean, it's just a little moment in the book, but I really loved that story. That seemed to be saying something deep about grief.
Yeah, I actually know Tico. Tico is a parrot who lives with Joanna Berger, who is a Rutgers professor, who was my graduate advisor. So I've known Tico since, I think, 1985. And Tico tends toward jealousy, and he attached emotionally to Joanna's mother-in-law was in the house in her last months, and he really liked her. He doesn't really like a lot of people, but he really liked her, and he hung around with her a lot, and he wouldn't let the hospice workers near her. But to me, the strangest thing of that whole story was that he sleeps in a room, and he never makes a sound at night, ever. It's dark. He's asleep.
Right.
He never makes a sound. The night that this woman died, and the people came and took her body away, he screamed and screamed and shrieked all night long. And that, again, you know, fits the definition of grief. It's altering your behavior when a companion is gone. So it's not just the big brain mammals like elephants and apes or something like that. Many birds, especially birds with social bonds, show a major change in behavior following the loss of a mate or a companion.
But before we head to a break, I wanted to ask you about another really powerful moment. It's the story of these chimpanzees watching the sunset together. And you write that if it looks like they're admiring a sunset, they probably are. I mean, that it's not a deeper reason than that necessarily. It looks pretty to us, so we stare at a sunset. Same thing with a group of chimpanzees. It's the same as us in that way.
Probably is.
Yeah?
I think it probably is. Yeah. Why else would they climb to the top of the trees and hold hands and stare at the sunset? Except it must look pretty to them. They're not going to eat it. It's not threatening them. They're oriented toward color the way we are because they're fruit eaters like we are fruit eaters. That's why we see colors vividly, and that's why they do. And they are probably, drawn to colors in a way that's very similar to how we are drawn to colors. We like colors. We like sunsets. Probably the same with them, because why else would they sit there holding hands gazing at the sunset?
Yeah. So we share that same aesthetic sense. We have the same impulses that draw us to color.
Seems that way.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that idea. Carl Safina is with us. Beyond Words is his book, What Animals Think and Feel. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Carl Safina. We're talking about his book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. He explored the wolves in the Lamar Valley in Yellowstone. Cynthia Moss was a terrific character about elephants. Rick McIntyre, another, he observes the wolves there. You say that has had eyes on wild wolves for more hours than any human ever has. Talk about him. I really liked him because he really gets at this idea of individuality for wolves.
Yes, I don't think anybody ever has known wolves the way Rick McIntyre knows wolves, because for 15 years, 365 days a year, no matter the downpours or the blizzards, he has gone into Yellowstone's Lamar Valley and watched the wolves there. He knows them. They are basically his family. He knows them as well as he knows any human being, and better than most of us know any human being. He's watched some wolves from the time they were tiny pups to the time that they died of old age. He understands the arc of their lifetimes, what they did, who they were with, what pack they were born into, what pack they later led. I don't think anyone has ever had insight and observational experience that comes close to that.
Mm.
Incredible guy. And you would think, I mean, I thought, this guy watches wolves. I mean, wolves are intense, you know, and he's intense about it. And he's probably going to be very, very unapproachable and difficult to be with. Or he's the nicest guy you could imagine.
Mm.
I mean, the fact is there's a lot of the day wolves don't do too much. When they do something, it's exciting. But a lot of the day, they may be resting for 6 or 8 hours, and you stand there for 6 or 8 hours, and you just talk about wolves, what kind of gloves you're wearing, does anybody have an extra sandwich in the car, things like that. You know, I mean, it's a kind of a funny experience in that way. But the thing about Rick that is so terrific is that he loves sharing. He loves telling stories, and he's mellow despite his intensity.
Mm.
Amazing guy.
You ask in the book this question: can a wolf be magnanimous? And you tell the story of a wolf that Rick knew called 21, which he calls it, in fact, the perfect wolf. Tell us the story about 21. This is a great story in the book.
Yeah. And one of his most memorable lines is that he says 21 was better at being a wolf than I've been at being a human being.
Yeah.
So the thing about 21 is that he lived at a time in the years soon after wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, when there was a tremendous amount of prey because they hadn't had any wolves for 60 years. The prey was kind of out of control, eating up everything, preventing the plants from regrowing and all this kind of stuff. So they rebalanced. But in that rebalancing, at first, the wolves exploded in numbers. So 21 lived at a time of really unusual high wolf density. And there was a lot of friction. And he was in a lot of fights. But he never lost a fight. Even though at times he was caught alone and attacked by 6 other wolves, and Rick was saying was something like from a Bruce Lee movie, he'd be thinking, a wolf cannot do what I'm watching this wolf do. He never lost a fight, but he never killed a vanquished rival.
Yeah.
And many wolves are killed in fights, but he never lost and he never killed. And then he died of old age. So, you know, the question really was, why did this wolf act that way? And it's very interesting to think about and speculate what made this particular wolf be able to afford, in a sense, to let a rival go. You know, he had to be at some level confident enough to think, I've made my point.
Yeah.
And it connects to a principle in animal behavior called the handicap principle, which is shown in some animals in some situations. Don't really have time to go into all of that, where basically they say, I have so much extra, I can show you that I can take a handicap. Humans do this kind of thing. It's like, I'll fight you with one hand behind my back. That's an indication of the handicap principle at work in humans, for instance. And the interesting thing is that there was one particular wolf that kept bothering him. He wasn't a threat bodily, but he was a sort of a genetic threat because they called this other wolf Casanova. And this wolf was he was a philanderer. He would wander around the packs and he would look for females who were interested in a little excitement and adventure. And they would sneak off for trysts. And, you know, if you're a wolf leading a pack, you don't really want another wolf like Casanova in around your daughters or anything like that. They're supposed to go and form a pack and be loyal. In fact, male wolves are generally more loyal to their mates than male humans. I've never heard of a wolf abandoning his family ever. So he kept running Casanova off, and at one point, you know, he had him pinned to the ground, and his sons were there ready to move in for the kill. And then he just popped his head back and stood back and let Casanova run off. And Rick said that the sons were looking like, why did Dad just let him go? But later, Casanova became the leader of a pack that included 21's grandchildren. So we don't foresee plot twists like that.
Yeah.
No one can, but evolution can factor in the probabilities of something like that. So by not killing that wolf who appeared to be a rival and a threat genetically, he actually helped ensure his own genetic legacy because this wolf became the mate and leader of a pack which had his 21's granddaughters in it, and he defended them literally to the death one day where they were all able to escape an attack from a rival pack, and Casanova was killed in that attack. So these things, I think, are just, you know, again, they just show the layers and the depth and what really goes on, and that these animals have lives.
Yeah.
They're not just there as scenery. They're not just marbles that are shaken across the landscape and roll around a little bit. They have lives that play out over years, and the trajectory of what happens is altered by things that happen, just as it is in our own lives.
The coalitions and vendettas and personalities and politics, all too human, as you put it. You saw that in those wolf lives.
Yes, that's what I was thinking about the wolves, all too human in many ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is language, do you think, Carl Safina, all that important in the scheme of things? I mean, you've talked about how most of our empathy, human empathy anyway, comes without actual words. There's so much to be said about body language and gestures and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Where do words fit in the broad sense of animals?
Right. Well, in the broad sense, like everything else, I think everything you see in humans, you can see some of in other animals, sometimes more developed and sometimes a lot less developed. Many animals communicate rather richly, really, and they have lots of different ways of communicating. But our kind of – and some animals have words. They have a specific sound or a specific thing that represents a specific thing. There are monkeys that have different words, for instance, that means leopard, get up in a tree, eagle, get out of the tree, snake, stand up in the grass. They have specific words. But our language has syntax and grammar and is vastly more complicated than the language of anything else that we know of. And I mean, then there are a couple of little indications that maybe dolphins are able to communicate extremely complicated thoughts to one another.
Yeah.
But that aside, the way that we can talk allows us to network all of our brains together in space and in time. You know, we can benefit from what other people have told us. A monkey might be able to say, "Snake, watch out." But a human can say, "Be careful over there. I saw a snake there yesterday." And that is a game changer, I think. So before we get too smug about that, I mean, there are many wonderful things about human beings. It would be great if we took these wonderful things and we always used them to honor the best about us, which is our capacity for empathy and compassion is potentially quite big. You know, unfortunately, our capacity for cruelty and destructiveness is also quite big, much bigger than any other creatures. So we are the creature of extremes. We take everything you can see in other animals and we run it to extremes in every direction. And I think that more than anything else is what makes us human.
You write about a man named John Ford, this Canadian researcher who focuses on free-living killer whales. He said something really interesting. He said he realized his own behavior was being modified by killer whales. What did he mean by that?
He was responding to their lead,
yeah,
in a way, is what he meant. And there are amazing, amazing things about killer whales. They, I think, are the most astonishing of the creatures that I got to know a little bit and delved into quite a lot. I have a friend who's a researcher, and he studies killer whale taxonomy and killer whale groups, mostly in the Antarctic. He's been walking along leads in the ice, cracks in the ice, and had killer whales stick their heads up right next to him. And they eat seals. They eat seals just like that. Mm-hmm. They don't eat people. They don't bother people ever. They've never overturned a boat or a kayak. They've never hurt anybody in the wild. And you have to wonder why that is. They eat mammals that are our size, and they chase them very energetically, and they don't bother us. At one point, he was walking along, a killer whale stuck his head up. He decided he wanted to see if it really understood he was there. So he picked up a piece of ice and he threw it in the direction of the whale. The whale grabbed the piece of ice and threw it right back at him. It was an instantaneous desire to interact. There are a couple of different stories of different researchers in different countries who got lost in fog following whales that had been acting a bit elusive. And then the whales came back to the boat and they allowed that. They just said, "I'm going to see where these whales are going to take me. They've come back. What are they doing?" And they followed them. And in the case of Ken Balcom, the guy that I spent the most time with, he followed them 15 miles through the fog. And when the fog suddenly opened up, his house was right there on the shore.
Wow.
And then they left.
Yeah.
I mean, what does that hint at about other minds who are here with us? Minds who seem to think about us that we never think about.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've been noticing this kind of trend on social media right now. People sharing videos of animals expressing, you know, emotion, and a lot of like unlikely animals, like cows being tender with people, and unlikely animals as friends, like tortoises and cats hanging out.
Right,
you know,
right.
What do you make of that? Does that represent something significant, kind of a new way of us all thinking about our relationship with the animals?
I think that the ubiquity of video cameras is another really game-changing thing in our relationship with animals, because we are getting to see, by the millions of us, we are getting to see animals do things that we never would have suspected, that never would have been able to be reported or would have been a story, you know, I saw a cow do this, I saw a lion do this. Mm. But everyone can simply whip out their cell phone and document it and share it with the entire world. So that is adding up to an incredibly rich mountain of information showing what other animals often do. Now, some of that stuff on the web is grossly misinterpreted, yeah, but yeah. Some of it is absolutely incredibly rich and wonderful.
Earlier, we were talking about that big question you asked Cynthia Moss, you know, what had observing elephants taught her about humanity. Now, she deflected the question, but we have about a minute left. Let me ask it of mm-hmm. you. Did this exploration in this book of animal feeling, did that tell you something about yourself, about humanity?
Yes, very much. I mean, that's unavoidable, and which is a good thing. I mean, the first thing is, yeah, Cynthia's main point was the question isn't how are other animals like us. The question is, who are other animals like us or not? Who are we here with? What is this world that we find ourselves in? But the thing that I really learned most about humans, I think, is that our technological abilities appear limitless. There's no end in sight for our technological cleverness and the things that we may invent. But our intellectual and emotional limitations are really, really stark. Our empathy is so partial. We're so capable of cruelty, and not just to other animals, but to other human beings as well. You know, we are still trafficking in human beings. We are still subjecting people to slavery. We still treat people in relationships or in working life in incredibly abusively. We still go to war. The great peace, the great dream of humanity is peace. We can't do it. We're so limited in these ways. And I think that if we understand our limitations, we could play to our strengths.
Carl Safina, his book is Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel, joined us from New York City today. Professor, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been really a terrific hour.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.